Welcome to the Taxcast from the Tax Justice Network. Around 20 minutes each month of news, scandal and analysis you won't find anywhere else. With me, Naomi Fowler. The Taxcast is available to everyone on www.tackletaxhavens.com. It's also on the Tax Justice Network's website, www.taxjustice.net/taxcast. You can subscribe to our RSS feed, to the Tax Justice Network's YouTube channel, email me on naomi@taxjustice.net, look for us on iTunes, or find us on a radio station near you. Coming up later, we'll be talking about burgers and why corporations are deserting the US. Also, we'll be discussing the Scottish no vote on independence. But first, a quick roundup of this month's Tax Justice news. The tax justice film, The Price We Pay, came out this month.
Does Apple Inc. own directly or indirectly AOI, AOE, and ASI?
Yes.
And where is AOI a tax resident?
It does not have a tax residency.
The film's directed by Harold Crooks and it's making its way around the world. It features key voices from the tax justice movement, so look out for that. If you thought all the increased attention on tax havens meant people and companies would be less likely to use them, sadly that's not the case. The last quarter was one of the highest value for offshore deals in the last 10 years. In Luxembourg, they've opened their brand new so-called Freeport, right next to the airport. It's an 11,000 square metre site where works of art, fine wines, vintage cars and all sorts of other luxury items can be stored. Luxembourg says it's diversifying the services it offers and it denies that this is a kind of fiscal no man's land. Now you have to chuckle at this one. Swiss tax authorities are reinvestigating a company suspected of avoiding taxes in Switzerland by offshoring assets in Jersey and Luxembourg. And at the time, the company was run by the current Swiss economics minister. It's not very patriotic of him, is it? It's a good job the OECD's on the case, or are they? Here's the OECD head on their latest action plan to tackle international tax avoidance.
We are putting an end to treaty abuse. We are rewriting the rules in transfer pricing, in particular in the area of the intangibles. And we will be providing all the countries with an overall picture of where the profits are, where the activities are through a country-by-country reporting.
Sounds great, doesn't it? Well, all's not what it seems. We'll be discussing this action plan later. The United Nations Conference on Trade and Development has called clearly for tax justice and firm, inclusive political leadership to tackle the threat of tax havens. Their latest report is critical of the slowness of the governments of wealthier nations to take action, as the main homes to multinational corporations and some of the world's secrecy jurisdictions. They want the UN Committee of Experts on International Cooperation in Tax Matters to play a bigger role and give greater voice to developing countries. They're also suggesting an international convention against tax abuse. Countries like the UK still massively underestimate the amount of tax they lose each year. That's according to a new report, Tax Evasion in 2014 and What Can Be Done About It, by accountant Richard Murphy. Tax evasion in the UK has gone up from an estimated £70 billion a year to £85 billion since 2010. Over the last decade, the government's cut the tax authority workforce by 43% and served up a diet of austerity. It's not all bad news, though. In the US, there's been some very surprising support for a bipartisan bill to eliminate anonymous shell corporations. Half of the entire Delaware legislature has signed a letter urging the bill's support that's been sent to Washington. Now, when a secrecy jurisdiction the size of Delaware's has had enough, something's definitely changing. And the eyes of tax authorities across Africa will be watching very closely a case in Uganda, where a court of appeal has made a landmark ruling agreeing the Uganda Revenue Authority does have jurisdiction to charge a possible $85 million in capital gains tax from the Netherlands-registered and incorporated company Zain International BV. The tax case arose after Zain sold part of its operations in Uganda to another European registered company for $10.7 billion. Zain's likely to contest the tax assessment. And that's the Tax Justice News Roundup. Now we're going to talk to John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network for his take on this month. Okay, John, so let's start off this month with Scotland and the independence vote. In the end, it was a no. I don't know if you feel the same, but I feel very conflicted over it because on the one hand, it represented a real political choice to break away from forces of conservatism and the rule of Westminster and London-based politicians. And after all, as they say, there's more pandas in Edinburgh Zoo than conservative MPs in Scotland. You know, we did see some real genuine political choices, and I think that was borne out by the very high turnout of the kind that hasn't been seen for a long time. On the other hand, the Scottish Nationalist Party was planning to go the kind of Irish screw everyone else route on tax and kind of launch into quite an aggressive tax competition to try to supposedly attract corporations to Scottish shores should the vote have gone their way, which of course it didn't.
Yes, this is one of the untold stories about the Scottish independence vote. And this concerns one of the key parts of the development strategy of the Scottish Nationalist Party, which is that they were planning to set a rate of corporation tax set at 3% below the corporation tax rate prevailing elsewhere in the United Kingdom. So the current tax rate would be 20% in the rest of the United Kingdom. And they were proposing to set a tax rate of 17%. And this engagement in tax competition can only have led one way, which is that the Northern Ireland government is also looking at engaging in tax competition. And if other parts, regions of the United Kingdom were able to achieve a certain amount of devolution, as is being discussed, particularly around tax policy, Wales might well have also wanted to go in the same way. So this was likely to precipitate tax wars within the United Kingdom, and a very dangerous process that would have been, because the United Kingdom generally has based its development strategy on tax competition, in other words, on trying to become the most tax competitive nation within the OECD. This would have led to a spiralling downwards, a race to the bottom on tax matters, which can only have been harmful to the United Kingdom and to other countries within the OECD, but particularly to other countries across the world. So a very harmful economic development strategy at the very, very heart of the Scottish Nationalist Party proposals.
Right, and it was pretty fascinating to watch the panic of the Westminster politicians kind of hot-footing it up to Scotland to talk about being family and, you know, even talked about defeating Hitler and all sorts of things. And they lined up all sorts of people intimately linked to the City of London and financial services to say they'd pull out of Scotland if there was a yes vote. Those same people, I'm sure, would have been the first in Downing Street after a yes vote, pressuring the government for business as usual. And there was a question of the pound as well, and whether or not Scotland would be able to use the pound after it became independent.
Well, one of the noticeable things that happened through this campaign was the huge lobbying, political lobbying, undertaken by the financial services industry and by its allies in London and at Westminster. We saw major Scottish institutions like the Royal Bank of Scotland threatening to withdraw from Scotland entirely and retrench to the City of London, arguably for fear that an independent Scotland would have led to tighter regulation of their activities. We also saw an extraordinary move by the Chancellor of the United Kingdom's Exchequer, George Osborne, threatening that if Scotland voted for independence, they would no longer be able to use the sterling. Now, of course, Scotland used the pound sterling long before it went into union with the rest of the United Kingdom, three centuries ago. At that time, of course, it was called the livre, but nonetheless, they used the pound before they became a member of the United Kingdom, and they were proposing to retain the use of the crown after leaving the United Kingdom. But the UK Chancellor threatened that they would not be able to do so. But it was extraordinary how much lobbying effort and how much political pressure was brought to bear on the voters of Scotland in the run-up to the referendum to try to keep them within the United Kingdom. And I think this is a reflection of several things. First of all, concern that a vote in favour of independence might have led to tighter regulation. It might also have led to higher rates of personal taxation, more progressive taxation for the wealthier Scots. But I think it also reflected Westminster's concern about the possibility of devolving tax powers in other areas, for example, tax powers on capital gains tax, on value-added tax, possibly stamp duties, possibly land value taxes. I think Westminster was very scared indeed of the possibility that an independent Scotland might actually lead to a very different tax regime, progressive taxation, more progressive taxation at a personal level, whilst at the same time they were talking about tax wars on corporate income taxes.
Right, and we don't know what kind of taxing powers Scotland may now get or not get, according to what happens as a result of talks about further devolved powers.
Well, what happened in the run-up to the referendum is that as the opinion polls began to suggest that there was just the possibility that the vote might be won by the independence side, at that stage all sorts of promises were being made by politicians in Westminster, some of whom, frankly, were not in a position to make any promises at all because they couldn't deliver on them. But now the promises have been made, it will be very interesting to see whether any of the promises are actually honoured and whether there will be a devolution of more taxing rights to the Scottish Parliament.
Right, so that's one to watch on the tax cast. Let's talk about the OECD. They've released their action plan on how to tackle international tax avoidance, things that are going to be discussed by the G20 in Australia. What's new here and what's promising here, or perhaps not promising? This is basically global tax policy being decided by 44 countries in the world, and many of them are part of the problem, not necessarily part of the solution.
Yes, from a tax justice point of view, what we've seen so far is not enormously encouraging. For example, on the country-by-country reporting standards, whilst the OECD are saying that this proposal they've come forward with is a major step forward in transparency, in reality, it's quite the opposite, because they're not proposing that companies should be required to make their accounting information available on a country-by-country basis available to the public. In other words, the level of transparency around their corporate country-by-country reporting standard is exceptionally low, and certainly that doesn't meet what we're looking for. We've seen some progress towards tackling the so-called hybrid mismatches. These occur where companies are able to claim deductions by classifying some types of their financing as debt in one country, but as equity in another country. In other words, they're using tax arbitrage to game the system. But overall, we're not enormously encouraged by what we've seen so far. What's clear, for example, is that there's no agreement on restricting the use of patent boxes. The UK government introduced patent boxes some years ago to provide favourable tax treatment for patented inventions and other innovations. So there's no progress there. And also, there's no progress on agreeing how to treat e-commerce, although the OECD has committed to undertaking further study on the whole issue of the digital economy. It's very likely that the United States will be able to block any progress towards arriving at a rational regime there. So overall, we think that there's a very real risk that we'll see no genuine progress overall.
Well, that's interesting you say that, because that's not really the story that's coming across in the mainstream media.
Well, the OECD have been very actively spinning this as a major success, but the truth is that the OECD are not requiring full transparency on country-by-country reporting, and other claims, for example, by the OECD, which have been reported in the media, that this is an extremely ambitious programme. Well, the only ambition is to push forward the process within an extremely tight deadline that takes us to the end of 2015. That is ambitious, but as a result of that ambition, the OECD has deliberately restricted the real ambition of what might be achieved, which is to shift away from the existing method of taxing companies, based upon the arm's length method, towards a formulary apportionment process. where there's more alignment of economic substance with the taxing rights in the different countries. And in that respect, this programme is exceedingly lacking in ambition, despite what the media have been reporting. There is a very real danger that once the proposals come forward, individual countries will only implement the bits that suit them, particularly countries like United Kingdom and United States. There is considerable corporate lobbying happening behind the scenes, and the corporate lobby is clearly winning the day.
Thanks, John. John Christensen at the Tax Justice Network. Now it's time for the TaxCast special feature. If you're partial to a burger or two, you may now want to join thousands of former customers of Burger King who don't want to eat there anymore. And they've even signed a petition that rhymes. Well, kind of. Keep Burger King American and pay your fair share. If not, I will dine elsewhere. So this month, the TaxCast takes a look at so-called corporate inversions and what we can do about them. In a recent public address, US President Obama said he's not too happy with what he's called unpatriotic corporate deserters.
A small but growing group of big corporations are fleeing the country to get out of paying taxes. They're keeping most of their business inside the United States, but they're basically renouncing their citizenship and declaring that they're based someplace else just to avoid paying their fair share.
President Obama's administration reckons the US may be losing $17 billion a year because of this practice. Back to Burger King. It very much looks like they've decided to buy the Canadian coffee chain Tim Hortons and pretend Tim Hortons bought them so they can say they're Canadian. Oh, and save a lot of money on taxes. Here's economist and tax justice campaigner Jim Henry explaining to the radio show Democracy Now! What they're up to.
Well, there are lots of kinds of inversions, but in this case, we have basically a U.S. company that, you know, with about 7,000 locations here, paying a higher corporate tax rate than it would if it were a Canadian company. And simply by switching that corporate headquarters to Canada, they can realize that gain. The company is denying that that's the motivation, but in fact, it basically amounts to a way of immediately cutting Burger King's taxes that are paid to the IRS. The Canadian tax rate officially is 27%, which is not much lower than ours. But in fact, effective tax rate in Canada is about 20% or lower. And because of the fact that they have a territorial tax, any U.S. profits that were received from those 6,000 restaurants offshore would not be taxed by Canada. So Canada is not getting any incremental revenue from it. And all that revenue is just being lost to the U.S. Treasury. The other thing that we've seen in the other 70 inversions to date is that companies have loaded up on foreign debt. So they typically will make the U.S. company borrow and then pay interest to the parent in a low-tax jurisdiction. So that's been a big pattern with inversions, and I would expect to see that here.
So no benefits to Canada, big losses for the U.S., and these inversions are on the rise. 47 US corporations moved their tax base overseas through corporate inversion in the last 10 years. That's way more than in the previous 20. And now, just this year, at least 50 are planning to do the same thing. Tax justice campaigner and accountant Richard Murphy. I've seen it explained as changing the fiction of their legal existence for tax reasons. What happens to the US as a result of this move?
What we know is that there's one definite loser in this arrangement, the USA. The US tax system is unique, it's perverse, it's bizarre, and it needs changing. But the way it works is this. If a US company has a subsidiary outside the USA, say in the UK or in Panama or in Bermuda or wherever that is, so long as the profits it makes are not sent back to the USA, they're not taxable in the USA. The moment those profits are sent back by way of dividend to the US, then they're taxable in full in the USA. Now, nobody else has this weird mix of what might be called a partly territorial tax with a worldwide tax, a completely unique feature of the US tax system. But what it has encouraged is multinational companies who will keep their profits outside the US. Now, Burger King is not the biggest player here. I mean, the biggest players are people like GE Capital and Microsoft and Apple, who have, you know, sums of money running into tens of billions outside the US, and even hundreds of billions in the case of Apple, which they're hiding outside the US from the US tax authorities, so tax isn't paid in the USA. So what an inversion does is actually mean that the money will never now go to the US in the case of Burger King. It can only go to Canada. Canada will never tax it. The US, which might have taxed it, now can't. And so the inversion has definitely cost the US some money at some time in the future, if the money were ever to have gone there. Now, you could say, well, actually, Burger King would have never sent the money to the US, so the US has not lost any money either. That's a difficult argument to put forward. And the reason why it's a difficult argument to put forward is that how do the shareholders get their return from a company which does forever hide its money outside its parent company jurisdiction, which was the US in the case of Burger King? Eventually, you end up with the farce where Apple was, for example, borrowing money in the US to pay dividends, and yet had tens of billions and even $100+ billion of money hidden in Bermuda, but which it couldn't use to pay the shareholders. So you end up with these really bizarre corporate practices because of this tax law. Burger King's argument is now they can be honest with their shareholders, they can move their money wherever they want, they can pay it back to their investors if that's appropriate, they don't have to worry about paying extra tax to the US as a result, as if that is some sort of a massive burden on the company to pay tax in the US, which has provided them with their headquarters and main market for so long. But in the process, the US has lost out because it has refused to come up with a sensible tax system.
Right. And often when you hear reports on this whole subject, you hear in the media quoting this 35% corporate tax levy, which is the highest in the developed world in the United States. That is very rarely what some of these very large multinational companies are paying. And there's all kinds of suggestions going on at the moment. Of course, on the right, we've got the call to repeal corporate tax in the United States.
Well, the best thing that the US could do, in my opinion, is that it could elect a Congress which could actually make up its mind about how to tax US corporations appropriately. In the US, domestic rates of tax are often in the very high teens, roughly half the rate of the headline that is published in the USA. But companies are paying tax. Companies are certainly, or certainly have not been paying tax at the headline rate. However, we still do have a massive problem, which is, as far as the US is concerned, it's going to be losing out on revenue. I mean, we're talking about it losing out on tens of billions and maybe hundreds of billions of revenue if all its major companies inverted. It also has lost influence over those companies, which is one reason why you have a tax system. You actually have a tax system to try to persuade companies to behave in certain ways. And if they invert and leave your territory, you have much less influence on them. And that is very important with regard to US economic policy. And corporations are, of course, the foundation in many ways of US wealth more than anywhere else's wealth, because this is a market-dominated economy. And so it's very strange that they would actually not want to have the influence that a tax system provides to them. But fundamentally, what we really do need is the US to actually get its head around the fact that it does need to have corporate tax reform, and that it can't survive without corporate taxes. Corporate taxes raise a significant amount of revenue in the States, which does help contain its massive budget deficit. So the corporate tax has a clear role to play, and that if they don't have a corporate tax, eventually they're going to have to cut services, which is, of course, exactly what the members of Congress, who will not approve a change in the corporate tax, want to happen. They're literally trying to deny what they consider to be the beast, that's the federal government, the revenue it needs to fulfil its policies. So we need to have some sanity introduced into US tax policy. The most insane way to deal with this is to abolish corporate tax. The idea that you actually stop tax avoidance by abolishing the tax seems to be the best way to reward the abuser that I can think of. It's a bit like saying, well, we'll stop murder by abolishing the crime of murder, therefore it won't exist anymore. We'll just have some dead people instead. It's almost as bizarre as that in its logic.
And so if we didn't have a corporate tax,
if we don't have a corporate tax in the USA, millions of people would then incorporate their own companies and not pay tax as a result, and their income tax yield would fall. Now, again, that may be what members of Congress want. But if that idea spread outside the US, and I've heard UK politicians saying, well, maybe the corporation tax is beyond its sell-by date here too, we would suddenly see a whole rash of tax avoidance break out. And we have to remember that, for example, in the UK, corporation tax was introduced in 1965, actually not that long ago, precisely to stop people avoiding tax by incorporating companies and not paying tax on the income, which was then rolling up tax-free. So we've got to have a corporation tax. So how do we make corporation tax work? Well, one way is that we negotiate, for example, common tax rates and common tax systems. And that is what the OECD would, to some degree, like us to do. They'd like there to be some convergence on tax rates, so there isn't tax competition. And they'd like us to all converge towards broadly similar tax bases. And you would hope that you would, as a consequence, not have tax competition and some of the abuses we've seen. I'm afraid to say that's actually, I think, pretty unlikely, because all countries are starting from different points in their agendas on tax, and the chance of commonality and convergence on any of these issues without some radical new idea coming onto the scene is very low.
And many people in the tax justice movement believe that radical alternative idea you're talking about, Richard, is unitary taxation. So tell us about that.
Like most things in tax, I think unitary taxation is not well understood. If we talk about unitary taxation, then the assumption has always been that you take one set of accounts, that is, for a group of companies as a whole, Burger King worldwide, and allocate its income on the basis of where its sales are, where its employees are, and where its physical assets, in their case, basically, literally, restaurants, fast food outlets, and allocate the profits to countries on the basis of where those three things are. The only difficulty with that is agreeing which set of accounts we'll use, and that can be quite hard, and then which profit we'll use, and also some serious thinking about which numbers we are going to apportion between states. But my guess is that unless we're willing to think radically, and I mean really radically, about the interactions between law, accounting, and the concept of the state, which are three things which are often in conflict, then we aren't going to come up with a solution which means that we can really carry on effectively taxing corporations. We've started. The European Union has looked at unitary taxation and has just begun to fathom the depths of the issues that raises. But actually pulling all those issues together is something that we in the tax justice movement, who have actually got the intellectual capacity to deal with these things, really need to focus on. Because if we've achieved anything, it's because we've offered solutions. And this may be the biggest solution we have yet to offer anywhere, if we can crack this problem for the benefit of the countries of the world.
Okay, but the OECD is not being very keen at all on unitary taxation so far. And of course, they weren't very keen on some of the other things which they're now starting to take on board. So do you think the same sort of thing's going to happen with unitary taxation as has happened with automatic information exchange, for example?
The last decade had been one of real achievement. I'd been told that country-by-country reporting would never happen. I can remember sitting in the UK Treasury in June 2009, I think John Christensen was present with me, and we were told automatic information exchange would not happen in our lifetimes. Beneficial ownership on public record was just an impossibility, and I could go on with other things that we've been told will never happen. And do you know what? They're all, in some way or other, on their way. Not perfectly, not exactly as we want them. And yet the world is changing. Now, if we can therefore persuade the OECD that automatic information exchange, which they said couldn't be done, is possible, and that country-by-country reporting, which they thought was never going to happen, is of use for beating tax avoidance, which they now admit is the case, then I think we should believe it possible that we can crack the problem of global international taxation of corporations. But we, I think, have proven that we can take these sorts of arguments forward and find what are potentially viable solutions. That's our challenge here. It's the biggest one we'll have taken on, but I think we've got to do it.
You've been listening to the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network. We'll be back next month.